Michel Roberts has written a dozen extremely successful novels, including The Looking Glass and Daughters of the House, which won the W.H. Smith Literary Award, was also shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Michel's also a poet and has written short stories, the most recent collection in 2010 being Mud, Stories of Sex and Love. Michel's half English and half French, so I imagine you must have enjoyed this quote from The Times. Michel Roberts is one of those writers descended perhaps as much from Monet and Debussy as Virginia Woolf or Keats. To read a book by her is to savour colour, sound, taste, texture and touch as never before. That's right, isn't it?
That'll do for a compliment.
But it's true, actually. I've just been reading Daughters of the House, and the subtlety with which you bring out the character and the foibles, the human weaknesses, if you like, in each of the two women whose story it is very redolent of those writers, I think, and that composer.
I realise, listening now, that that book works as a duet, and you could see it sung. I think one aria would be the more prim and priggish child, Thérèse, who dreams she's seen the Virgin Mary in a very conventional way. And the music for the other one, Léonie, would have to be a bit more discordant and also voluptuous, because she's rather greedy and materialistic. And the vision she has is much more interesting, I think. It's a vision of perhaps a Jewish woman who died in the war.
And it's also their relationship with this house in France and the events that, as you say, happened during the war, which sort of haunt them both.
I've always wanted to write a novel in which people sense your life was fully realised, because I think that's what my work's all about, really, is celebrating the human body, perhaps particularly the female body. Mm. And so houses sometimes represent maternal bodies or sacred containers, and they have a life of their own, and they're full of ghosts, and people have to negotiate their way around them, and they're full of stories and bad things going on in attics and cellars.
And you do spend your time biculturally, don't you? Because you were partially in France and partially in England.
Yes, I discovered that I needed to do that. My childhood was spent going back and forth across the Channel. So it was a movement of to and fro that is so deep in me, I can't ever get rid of it and don't want to. So now that I'm older and luckily had the money to buy a little house in France, I've discovered that I can keep making that movement back and forth, back and forth. And the house in France represents my French self, my French soul, my French root. It represents my mother's heritage. I love to speak French because, of course, that's a very particular music of language. And it's where I do a lot of my writing because it's so quiet. I live in the middle of the countryside. And no, it's not quiet. It's very noisy. It's full of cows mooing, people shooting animals, tractors hurtling about, the milking machine and the farm, all kinds of bird song. But I still call that silence.
Now, the first music we're going to hear, I think, is probably slightly prompted by your Catholic upbringing.
Yes, I've chosen Bach's Magnificat, and I've chosen his version that he wrote with the Latin text too. And what's interesting there is that I realised that he was doing a bit of a back and forth, perhaps, between Lutheranism and Catholicism, between a Latin text and a German text. And that speaks to me strongly, I think. This music springs directly from my Catholic childhood. I had one kind of Catholic childhood in England, going to a little convent school, and a Catholic childhood in France, which just involved going to high mass. And in the village in France, Catholicism was something just totally ordinary. So this Magnificat reminds me of that time. I wanted to play the whole thing, but it's too long, so I've suggested that we listen to the ending. Because in fact, there's something quite cyclical about this work. The ending brings you back round to the beginning. And this is a song of joy and triumph. And I love the way that it ends on that note, as well as having begun on that note.
Thank you.
The song Mary sings after the angel has come to her and told her that she's going to become pregnant with Jesus, who's going to save the world. And then she whizzes off to see her cousin Elizabeth, who's also pregnant. And the two women embrace each other. And Mary sings the Magnificat. So it's a potent and poignant moment for me, because it's not only Mary rejoicing, according to Christian theology, if you like, but there's this image of two women, both pregnant, embracing. It's very beautiful, I think.
Well, you're beginning and ending with Bach, and actually that particular moment ends on a chord that has yet to be resolved, so the programme is opening out. We heard Gloria Patri from the Magnificat in D major, BWV 243 by Bach, La Chapelle Royale and Collegium Vocale were directed by Philippe Herrevega. Now, the Virgin Mary, who played, obviously, a rather dominant role in the music we've just heard, is here again in this next music, which is by another Baroque master, of course.
Yes, I love Handel's music. I think because he's combining, as in this piece we're going to hear, something very operatic with something deeply spiritual. And it's the way he brings those two things together. I suppose until I listened to a lot of Handel, I hadn't realised that religious music could draw upon what seems a tradition of opera. And I think, having gone to Italy, he'd obviously learnt a fantastic amount about European opera and was able to incorporate it into his own writing.
And of course, a lot of those pieces which started off as liturgical, really, or at least sacred in sentiment, have translated, haven't they, like Theodora, into the opera house very successfully.
It's funny because it can go both ways. I mean, just as European theatre began in the church, in the nave of the church, with the Easter lamentations, with Christ calling from the cross, then it moves outside and becomes mystery plays and so on. It seems as though things can work the other way round. It's very exciting that dialogue can continue all these hundreds of years later.
And probably in your area of France, you have lots of statues to the Virgin Mary.
Yes, I live in a very traditionally Catholic area of northwestern France, where they survived the French Revolution, hiding priests and hiding nuns. They're certainly not socialist people I live amongst. And at every crossroads, there's a crucifix, which can just mean this is a crossroads, but it's become, over the centuries, a religious icon. And very often at its heart, there's a little niche with a little Madonna in. Or else you'll simply get a statue of the Virgin. And she's often the local Virgin, because, as you know, all over France, the Virgin was appearing in the late 19th century, mid-19th century, to little girls and boys. And we've got our very own Virgin in the bit of France I live in. And she's very powerful and pagan-looking. She's got a dark red dress, she's got a big red headdress on, and she's got stars flying around her head. She doesn't look a bit like the traditional namby-pamby 19th century Virgin on holy pictures.
And which of those two do you think this music comes closest to?
I think very much that latter Virgin, because she is still invoked, actually, by my fellow country people as the person who might send thunderbolts and punishments. And if something terrible happens, like the French government was going to bury nuclear waste in our little département, and little cardboard signs sprang out all along the local back roads in French saying, "Oh, lady, spare us, Virgin, spare us your wrath, your terrible rod." So this piece we're going to listen to now is Handel celebrating the people having been rescued from a terrible disaster, an earthquake. And the Virgin, you get the feeling she might have been the one who sent the earthquake to punish people's sins, but then because people repented and prayed to her, she let it pass over them. Oh.
Sorga pure dal orrido averno, from Donna che in ciel di tanta luce splendi, the Handel cantata. And Sophie von Otter was the soprano with Musica Antica Köln, directed by Reinhard Goebel. Now, I can't help asking you, after what you've been telling us, Michelle Roberts, whether you are still a committed Catholic.
No, I'm not. You know how you can be part-time this and part-time that. So sometimes I'm a part-time agnostic, sometimes I'm a part-time atheist, sometimes I'm a part-time heretic. And actually, I think that last label is the one that suits me best quite a lot of the time when I'm writing, because although I found the Catholic Church a misogynistic institution full of hatred of women, hatred of women's bodies and sexuality and creativity and beauty, awful, awful church to be in as a woman, yet nonetheless, having struggled my way out of it to find somewhere better to be, of course, what the church has given me is a great treasure house of stories and images and, of course, music, such as we've been hearing. So I think to be a committed Catholic would be like being committed to prison. But as an uncommitted, heretical ex-Catholic, I can rejoice in a certain legacy of beauty from the church.
One of the reasons I asked you is because the background to the next music comes from a far more profane part of your experience, parties in the 80s, I think. And in particular, hearing Julie Christie and her partner Duncan Campbell singing this song, and it's redolent for you, I think, of a kind of party time.
Yes, the kind of left-wing and feminist movement I was involved in the 1970s was really quite carnivalesque. People these days can have a very dour view of those times in the 70s and mock them and caricature us and so on. But of course they were painful times because we were trying to change the world and change the culture and change ourselves. I mean, how idealistic can you be? But there was a lot of partying because liberation involved joy. Also, when you'd kicked over the traces, you did feel quite cheerful, so you'd throw a party. And I was involved in the counterculture. It was a very public kind of time. People lived together in groups. They took their children everywhere. There was masses of live music. For example, when I was involved in the listings magazine City Limits, which had broken away from Time Out so that we could all have equal pay, including the cleaners, we used to have benefits, all kinds of gigs. And Duncan Campbell, who was at that time in the newsroom, he is the companion of Julie Christie, and they were great duetters at parties. And I remember them singing Jacques Brel's La Chanson des Vieux Amants. And what's very moving about this song is that it not only describes a long-term relationship with all its ups and downs in this very charming and wry way, but it's not about a marriage as such, and it's not about settling down and having babies. It's celebrating a kind of love that doesn't necessarily include children. And because that was true for so many of my contemporaries, it's rather wonderful to find Brel celebrating it in this song.
Bien sûr, nous eûmes des orages, vingt ans d'amour, c'est l'amour folle. Mille fois tu pris ton bagage, mille fois je pris mon envol. Et chaque meuble se souvient dans cette chambre sans berceau des éclats des vieilles tempêtes. Plus rien ne ressemblait à rien, tu avais perdu le goût de l'eau et moi celui de la conquête. Mais mon amour, mon doux, mon tendre, mon merveilleux amour, de l'aube claire jusqu'à la fin du jour, je t'aime encore. Moi je sais d'où tes sortilèges, tu sais tous mes envoûtements. m'a gardé de piège en piège. Je t'ai perdu de temps en temps. Bien sûr, tu pris quelques amants. Il fallait bien passer le temps. Il faut bien que le corps exulte. Finalement, finalement, il nous fallut bien du talent pour être vieux sans être adulte. Mon amour, mon doux, mon tendre, mon merveilleux amour, de l'aube claire jusqu'à la fin du jour, je t'aime encore. Je t'aime. Et plus le temps nous fait cortège, et plus le temps nous fait tourment. Mais n'est-ce pas le pire piège? De vivre en paix pour des amants. Bien sûr, tu pleures un peu moins tôt, je me déchire un peu plus tard, nous protégeons moins nos mystères. On laisse moins faire le hasard, on se méfie du fil de l'eau, mais c'est toujours la tendre guerre. À la fin du jour, je t'aime encore, tu sais, je t'aime.
There are lots of interesting things about that. I mean, if one just takes those last few lines, oh mon amour, mon doux, mon tendre, mon merveilleux amour, de l'aube claire jusqu'à la fin du jour, je t'aime encore, tu sais, je t'aime. It kind of breathes a languorous love, doesn't it? And the interesting thing is that, like so much music that we love, it's actually a rather sad minor key piece, even though it's extolling a kind of ecstaticism.
Yes, it's interesting because earlier in the song, Jacques Brel says, il faut bien que le corps exulte. So that's the jouissance of making love. And yet, as you say, there's this undertow of melancholy, perhaps because it's a truthful song. It's talking about a long time love affair, whereas, of course, a lot of pop music will celebrate the short one and the longing for the one who hasn't yet turned up. So over many years, he's singing about the ups and downs, the reality of perhaps letting the other person down, the other person is unfaithful sometimes, you go through very hard times, and I think that's what gives you the minor key, the melancholy is.
But I still think, even despite what you say, that it's interesting that we invest our deepest emotions in the cathartic element of something that is sad. As after all, the French called an orgasm le petit mort, don't they?
Yes, they do. I suppose I think human beings are always searching for ecstasy, for ecstatic release. And some of that religious music we heard, first of all, I think that's rehearsing one level of ecstatic release, which is through calling on God, calling on the Madonna, mystical union with the divine. On a more profane level, I won't separate soul and body because I think they're absolutely integrated in this music, but on a more profane level, it's just sex, as it were. For me, there's more joy in that song than perhaps there is for you. But maybe that's the way as a poet, I think a lot of poetry and song is written out of loss and sadness. And this song is saying we've come to the end of our lives, perhaps. You know, after many, many years, we're not quite sure what is waiting for us out on the landing there. So no, maybe that's what you're hearing too.
Yes, no, I found something extremely amorous about it, and in that sense, very joyous. La chanson des vieux amants, Jacques Brel. I mean, interestingly, Michelle Roberts, and this is where we come perhaps to the kind of metaphysical nature of love and religion, how they come together in the works of George Herbert or John Donne, for example. You did even think of being a contemplative at one point, didn't you?
Well, as a result of reading those two poets who you've just mentioned, because I realised that ecstasy and rapture could be had, as it were, face to face with God. I think my idea of being a nun, a contemplative nun, a Carmelite even, was that you'd be alone in your cell, in rapturous communion with God, and then occasionally you might go down to this refectory and have some rather nice red wine and very, very good omelette, and then stroll around the cloisters with your sisters discussing the finer points of ecstatic rapture. When I realised that nuns wore rather ugly garments made of polyester and had to do what the bishop told them, and the glamour dissipated. And also I'd just discovered the life of the intellect. I'd just gone to university, and I think the search for ecstasy just redirected itself towards the library. And it was reading where I found ecstasy.
I think probably, Michelle, you came across Hildegard of Bingen, of course, much earlier a century, when you were, in fact, studying 15th, 16th, 17th century mysticism.
Yes. What was wonderful about the course I did at university, it was called Medieval English Language and Literature. And therefore, I could read a great deal of medieval religious poetry and also medieval English writings, which were translated often from French or German. These Middle English texts are always, nearly always based on originals in Germany or France or Italy, although there was, of course, also an English school of mystics with amazing people in it. Hildegard of Bingen was even earlier. She was 12th century. And what's remarkable about her, for me, is that she managed to continue being a nun, but also be a rebel. So she was put into the convent, as were so many small girls. It was a place to be educated, probably a pretty good place to be, because you were perhaps safer than in the world outside in some ways. Risks of childbirth averted, all kinds of horrors. She grew up to be someone who had mystical visions, who ran her convent extremely well, but who stood up to the bishop. She used to let her sisters wear gold crowns in the choir and special cloaks, because she thought, if you're praising God and singing this music he's given me to praise him with, then you're going to have gold cloaks and crowns, and whatever the bishop says, we're going to do it. She wrote about nature, she wrote about medicine. She suffered from blinding migraines, which some people think now perhaps contributed to her ecstatic visual experiences. Her music is very pure.
It's very steeped in Gregorian plainchant.
Yes.
And that gives it that wonderful, timeless mystery.
Yes, I don't think listening to this that you'd automatically dive straight to the 12th century. It's exciting for me to know that it is from that time, because that saw a great renaissance of Christian life, of new forms of devotion. The Virgin sort of came back in as an icon of semi-worship, that the church was being very renewed in the 12th century, and great mystical writers like St. Bernard making canticles to the Virgin. So here's Hildegard making her own. It's a rather wonderful song, this. I find it very erotic. There are images of the love of God for the soul, which are about, you know, entering in and giving you rapture. But it's also specifically, I think, to do with the Virgin conceiving. So quite sexy stuff, really.
Nam exuper in fusio.
in symphonia sonet. Propter dulcissima virgine, et laudabilem Mariam. Dei genet
Your flesh has known delight, like the grassland touched by dew and immersed in its freshness. The actual Latin is even more erotic in its sound, viscera or viscera.
Yes.
So it is extraordinary how even in that kind of directly sacred song, that sort of metaphysical nature was present.
I suppose somebody like Hildegard of Bingen was, because she was a very learned woman, able to draw on her knowledge of the Old Testament, of Psalms, of the Song of Songs. And there is that thread, I think, that goes through the Christian liturgy, as though the poets who were Christians and who were making the liturgy and making the music, they weren't perhaps totally orthodox at all. They wanted to celebrate the body and nature, and they didn't believe perhaps that the spirit was so totally separate from the body. And I think we hear that, especially I think with that beautiful voice of Margaret Philpott.
It's almost like a countertenor, isn't it?
Yes. It's the group Gothic Voices has the wonderful Emma Kirkby singing with them, and I love her voice. But I think here, this contralto depth of sound is so wonderful.
Ave Generosa by Hildegard of Bingen. We heard Margaret Philpott of Gothic Voices, directed by Christopher Page. Well, we're going to a very different sensibility, but no less sensuous for that. Next, Michelle, what was your principal reason for choosing this next music sung by Maurizio?
I suppose Marisa is somebody I was told about and commanded to listen to fairly recently. It's as though with the opening up to what gets called world music, and that's partly to do with what you can hear on the radio, but it's partly about the kind of concerts you can go to. We seem as a culture in Britain to be just very open now. Of course, technology helps too, to music from all around the world. Probably many people have known Marisa for much longer than I have, but it's just simply various different friends were all suddenly saying, she sings fado, it's incredible stuff. And I said, you know, what's fado? And discovered it was Portuguese blues. And I went to hear her sing. And of course, you can't separate the voice and the depth of feeling in fado, as well as the control of these songs, from Marisa herself, who appears like a great goddess. She's very tall, she's beautiful, she wears sumptuous flowing garments. It's a knockout to experience her in concert.
Só quem bala no peito dores amargas e secretas é que em noites de luar pode entender os poetas. E eu que arrasto amarguras que nunca arrastou ninguém, tenho alma para sentir a quem bala no peito, dores amargas e secretas, é que em noites de luar podem entender os poetas. E o que arrasto amarguras que nunca arrasto ninguém. Tenho a alma para sentir a dos poetas também. Dos poetas também.
Poetas, that was Maritza. Now, it is another female performer, actually, Michelle Roberts, that has inspired this next music, which is Handel. Although I think it has an association for you, not only with your then husband, Jim, but also with your sister.
Yes, I first heard Handel's Messiah, well, parts of it, at my little convent school in England. We actually, for the Christmas carol concert, used to sing bits of the Messiah to our long-suffering parents. I think our teachers were pretty ambitious, actually. All these little girls in rows, in white frocks, belting out bits of the Messiah. My elder sister Jackie sang solo little bits of recitative. When she was 43, she became very ill and began to die, and I helped care for her. I was married then to Jim, who was an artist and who was very supportive while I was helping to look after my sister. And he took me away on holiday, and we were whizzing around Italy in his little blue MGB with the top down and playing music on the stereo. He was really trying to cheer me up, and we played this version sung by Kathleen Ferrier. And I just find her voice amazing. I don't think there's ever been another voice like it since. And this particular piece, it somehow embodies the utmost consolation. It has such sorrow in it, I think, but it's about not exactly transcendence, but hope. At the time, I played it over and over and over as we sped around Italy, weeping tears of sorrow for my sister, but also feeling this sense of somebody calling to me out of the darkness. There is a voice in the darkness, and it's telling you this is the human condition. You're in a vast body of people, many of whom are dead, some have still to come to life. Sorrow is what can connect us.
Thank you.
O Thou That Tellest Good Tidings to Zion, from Handel's Messiah. Kathleen Ferrier with the London Philharmonic, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. Blues now with Bob Dylan, and I imagine that for a writer, having lyrics of this sort of originality must always be very attractive, and especially when they're married to such memorable tunes.
That's spot on, Michael. That's exactly the reason I've chosen this particular song, because I think the lyrics are so fine and so special. I listened to Bob Dylan all through my youth, 20s, 30s. I go on listening to Dylan. We could all get into discussions late into the night about what made his lyrics so wonderful. I've heard learned professors give university lectures about his debt to Keats, that you don't have to say he's better or worse than Keats. You actually look at the way that he learnt from Keats. So this is Tangled Up in Blue from Blood on the Tracks, and it's one of the great songs. I think I sing almost everything that I've been talking about to you today in the bath, when I'm going around the supermarket, when I'm walking along the street. Tangled Up in Blue bursts out of me, perhaps when I'm feeling sad, needing to get a grip on things.
Early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress, Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night, both agreeing it was best. And she turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. Job in the great north woods, working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a be employed, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind, and I just grew. Place and I stopped in for a beer. I just kept looking at the side of her face in the spotlight so clear. Later on when the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there in back of my chair. I said, Timmy, don't I know your name? I muttered something underneath my breath. She studied the lines of my face. I must admit, felt a little uneasy when she bent down to tie the laces of my shoes. Pipe. I thought you'd never say hello, she said, you look like a silent type. Then she opened up a book of poems and handed it to me, written by an Italian poet from the 13th century. And every one of them words rang true and glowed like burning coal, pouring off of every page like it was written in my soul. But me to you, tangled up in blue.
Tangled Up in Blue, Bob Dylan. It's funny because if you were to say, you know, take that voice just simply on its own, it's not a very beautiful instrument.
I don't think anybody claims that Dylan is one of the great singers. It's his genius as a musician and a lyric writer.
But it also is because the voice is him, isn't it, that yes. actually we've come to rather love it.
Yes.
I mean, the fact it's slightly thin and strangulated almost adds to...
Yes, I find it quite hoarse and quite rough. It makes me think of, you know, Sellers with troubadours playing and everyone's smoking like mad and lots of drugs, lots of beer, and that's the kind of voice you end up with after a bit. That's fantasy, that's myth. But yes, the voice is his signature.
Tangled Up in Blue. Well, Michelle Roberts, we're going to finish as we began, which is a nice coda and also a feeling of completeness, which novelists and composers enjoy, by ending with Bach and one of the incomparable pieces for solo cello.
I wanted to hear this again and hope lots of people, if they're hearing it for the first time, may love it as much as I do, simply because, as you say, it's incomparable. It's very hard for me to speak about it in words that make sense. We're going to hear the Saraband from the first suite because, of course, the Saraband comes back and back and back in all the others. And I suppose this Saraband, I think, is just particularly beautiful. It's very grave, it's very measured, but the cello keeps plunging down, and it's that plunge. I don't know what the musical term is for that. That's partly what makes me love it so much.
Well, I think they use the open strings too to great effect, and even the low strings on the cello, even when they're stopped, they have a wonderful kind of sonorous resonance. That was the Saraband from the Cello Suite No. 1 in G Major, BWV 1007, by Bach, played by Pablo Casals. Michelle, your last book was Ignorance, which was published in May this year. Is there another one on the horizon?
Yes, there is. I had my usual lying fallow period when I think, shall I have a nervous breakdown or just perhaps I should give up writing altogether? Oh, God, I can't write a word. And you just have to go through it. It's chaotic and silent, and it always happens, and I always forget about it. And then suddenly an image comes, a voice says a couple of words in your ear, a little tug on the earlobe, and you think, ah. So I'm writing funny pieces of memoir at the moment, all unpublishable, because they're about my disgraceful behaviour, featuring living people. But I'm also beginning a novel, I think. It's a series of interlinked stories about a chef.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle Roberts, and we look forward to reading both of those.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time with you. Thank you.
Michelle Roberts was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the choreographer and former Strictly Come Dancing judge, Arlene Phillips. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
The critics didn't much know what to make of the music of Claude Debussy. One of them said it was like a kind of grey mist that you wanted to pierce to see if there was actually anything there. Well, this week, I'll be trying to disperse some of that mist and give you a clearer view of Debussy and his complicated private life, and particularly from the point of view of the music he composed for his own instrument, the piano. Debussy as Composer of the Week, part of the piano season on the BBC, every day this week at 12 noon and again at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, we had quite a treat in yesterday's Opera on Three with one of Mozart's last works, The Magic Flute. It's an opera where true love and jealousy combine in an imaginary ancient Egypt. And with its evil Queen of the Night, the giant serpent, pairs of lovers and, of course, the magic flute, it could well be a pantomime farce, but it just happens to have some of the greatest music Mozart ever wrote. The performance was recorded at the 2012 Salzburg Festival with the veteran period instrument specialist Nicolas Arnoncourt conducting his longtime ensemble, the Vienna Concertus Musicus. If you didn't hear it or you'd like to hear it again, you can catch up with Mozart's Magic Flute, yesterday's opera on three. Just go to the Radio 3 homepage. Well, looking ahead to this afternoon here on Radio 3, 4 o'clock is Choral Evensong, another chance to hear Wednesday's service from Winchester College Chapel, and that's followed by the choir with Alad Jones at 5 o'clock. This week he spotlights the pivotal role of the choral accompanist. That's here on BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM and on digital radio. It's 1 o'clock now, time for the news with Vaughan Savage.
As the Conservatives gather for their conference in Birmingham, the Prime Minister has confirmed that the government will have to agree more welfare cuts before the next general election. He said the rich must pay their fair share, but ruled out a mansion tax or cuts to pensioners' universal benefits. Mr Cameron also said he was prepared to veto a new budget for the European Union if he considers it too high. The Prime Minister also said that the BBC needed to look into allegations of sexual abuse made against Sir Jimmy Savile. He described the accusations as truly shocking. A number of women have claimed they were abused by him as teenagers, some of them on BBC premises. A special church service has been held in Machynlleth in mid-Wales for the missing 5-year-old April Jones, who was abducted in the town 6 days ago. More than 600 people walked in silence from the estate where April lived to St Peter's Church. A 46-year-old local man, Mark Bridger, will appear before magistrates tomorrow, charged with her murder. 2 people have been arrested after a 12-year-old boy was killed in a hit-and-run accident in Bradford. The boy was on a crossing when he was struck by a car, which moments earlier had sped away after being stopped by police. The Philippine government has reached an agreement with the country's largest Muslim rebel group to end a conflict that has killed more than 120,000 people over 4 decades. A new autonomous region will be created in the southern island of Mindanao, which will give the Muslim population greater political powers. A protest convoy against American drone attacks in Pakistan, led by the Pakistani cricketer turned politician Imran Khan, has reached the borders of the tribal region of South Waziristan. The Pakistani authorities say it won't be allowed any further because of threats by Taliban militants. The weather: a fine dry day for most places, although cloud and some showers could affect the southwest later. Top temperatures: 14 Celsius in southeast England, 11 in northern Scotland. The BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
Playing the piano for me is the best way I know of letting off steam and expressing myself. And in fact, looking back, I'm sure it made me a much nicer teenager for my family to live with.
It doesn't matter at what point in the instrument's history you stop and listen. It still seems quite incredible that hitting a string with a hammer can result in such a kaleidoscope of colour.
Piano Season on BBC Radio 3.
And now, as part of the Piano Season on the BBC, here's Lucy Skeeping with today's edition of the Early Music Show.
It's generally agreed that one of the more notable entrances onto the stage of musical history happened in the final few years of the 17th century, when a Florentine gentleman, Bartolomeo Cristofori, proudly announced his latest invention, a gravicembalo con piano e forte, he called it. In other words, a harpsichord that was capable of playing both soft and loud. This was the birth of the piano. And by the end of the 1700s, the instrument had reached adolescence, with composers such as J.C. Bach and Clementi in London and Mozart in Vienna absolutely revelling in the new expressive possibilities that this continually improving keyboard instrument had to offer. It had become a crucial means of bringing them and their music before the general public. Later would come the touring piano virtuosi, the technically flamboyant pianist composers who'd make such a huge impression on the early 19th century. But before them, in between, we come across a fascinating and colourful figure, a musician who did a great deal to establish the style and form of the piano concert, and who even got personally involved in the way the instrument itself was constructed. That man, largely forgotten today, is the subject of this early music show. He was from Bohemia, and he was called Jan Ladislav Dusek.